Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has spent his life naval intelligence is our first guest, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Captain James Fennell. He completed his distinguished service in uniform to the United States Navy as the Director of Intelligence and Information Operations for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Few people understand the threat from the Chinese Communist Party's People's Liberation Army, and more generally, the party and its apparatuses, then does Jim Fennell, and we're delighted to have him back as always. Jim, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio once again. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Great. Glad to be with you.
You are continuing to contribute very actively to the public policy debate about China, and I wanted to turn to you for a quick assessment of what you make of the announcement yesterday that the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia are forging a partnership to manufacture in Australia nuclear-powered attack submarines for the Australian Navy based on U.S. technologies and designs. Knowing, as both of us do, of the threat that the Chinese Navy and military and Communist Party represent to Australia, I think we're inclined to favor this, but I wanted to take stock with you about both your take on the understanding that's been arrived at and its implications.
Well, Frank, I think this announcement by the three leaders of United States, Australia, and UK is a significant step because it really draws together the three nations to take a stand, I think, at least in the symbolic way right now, of saying that they're going to try to confront the PRC. So in that sense, I'm very happy about that. But like with the pivot to the Pacific that the Obama administration had in 2011, this will all depend upon what actually really gets done. The gist of this for the Australians is that they signed an agreement in 2016 to buy French submarines, a nuclear design that they were going to retrofit into a diesel, conventional powered submarine. And it squandered here for 5 years and millions of dollars spent and nothing was produced. And so there was growing frustration, I think, in Australia that they were just not getting the submarines that they needed to replace their aging Collins class. So this for them is a big step forward because it brings them into the nuclear submarine community that only the U.S. and the U.K. have shared the same technology. So Australia will now be a partner in that. It'll probably take them 10 years to be able to produce these boats and have them operating in Australia. And so my concern is that in that decade of concern that we talk about frequently on the show here, that we need something in the interim. And so hopefully what this agreement will do beyond just the plans that are going to come up over the next year and a half, how to build these nuclear submarines for Australia and how to share artificial intelligence and quantum technologies. But maybe it will open up the United States Navy to be able to operate out of Australian ports. And this is important because with the Chinese DF-21 and DF-26 ballistic missiles that can target our naval forces in port in Japan, this now provides us maybe another opportunity to operate outside of those threat envelopes, but still be able to get into the fight quickly. For instance, from Perth to Singapore is a three-day transit, which will allow U.S. Navy ships or submarines to be able to get in range of Chinese Navy vessels operating in the South China Sea and be able to launch missiles at them. So this is, I think, the benefit right now is it will open up the ability for United States nuclear submarines to be able to go into Australia. They haven't talked about that in the formal agreement, but I'm hearing rumors down under that that's what they would like to do.
You've sort of alluded to two pieces of this that I do find a bit concerning. One is that, as you know better than anybody, Jim, the nuclear-powered systems of the United States Navy are among the crown jewels of our military and the most closely guarded secrets in the Pentagon, and rightly so. What are the chances that in the course of this kind of collaboration, we will see a compromise of that technology, especially given the very active presence of the Chinese, at least to this point, in Australia, and their very aggressive intelligence collection operations there and indeed elsewhere in the region? And secondly, the problem that you sort of alluded to there, Jim, that this is a long-term project, 10 years may be conservative, truthfully, but how important is it that we be taking steps in the near term to work, defend Australia and build up this this tripartite relationship?
Yeah, I think that the security aspect is, there's no question about that. And so any of this agreement, and there's a commitment to come up with a plan, a substantive plan in the next 18 months, that must, from the U.S. side, must have strict controls in security procedures. It will require embedded American naval officers and security personnel, I think, to be able to ensure that this technology is guarded. And if there's a, you know, even a hint of a violation, that, you know, the whole thing would, you know, maybe expire. So we can't allow that to be put at risk. But on the other hand, the idea that we are now able to interject our nuclear submarines to an area that gives us a different, we're going to be able to spread the field, if you will, and make China have to worry about where we're coming from, not just from Guam or Sasebo or Yokosuka. So I think this is our West Coast. So I think this is an opportunity for us to expand that. But in another way, it also allows us to work on things like water space management with the Australian Navy and the Royal Navy. And we really should be including the Japanese Navy and the Taiwan Navy that have shared submarine force interests, so that we can decompose that water space and make sure we're maximizing the use of our submarines to counter the Chinese threat.
Yeah, those seem to be really important points. Are there other things, Jim, that strike you as you look at what the Australians bring to the fight that that are obvious places where we could make further collaborations, perhaps building off of this important enhancement to our relationship?
Well, in the statements from the governments that was referenced was the sharing also in the development of artificial intelligence and quantum technology. And I would, you know, that all gets into the cyber arena. So I think from that perspective, Australia and the UK both leading in many ways in, you know, signals intelligence and cyber activities, the three of us working together in a unique way that will allow us to also put at risk the Chinese, the strategic support force, which is their cyber force, if you will. And so this is another area that I think that we can, this agreement's a benefit to us. We already have the Five Eyes intelligence sharing agreement, but with New Zealand's position right now and their response already to this, the Prime Minister of New Zealand already came out and said, we will now not allow Australian nuclear submarines into New Zealand ports. I mean, this is another way for us to continue to move forward in the cyber arena without having to worry about being compromised by, you know, where they're going with China. It's unfortunate the Australians aren't happy about that, but for now, this gives us that ability to do that.
What we're looking at, I think, unfortunately, is they are no longer part of a reliable part of the Five Eyes partnership. And I think it would also behoove us to underscore that the United Kingdom had best steer clear of Huawei if they want to be part of this relationship with Australia, as well as, of course, that Five Eye intelligence sharing operation. What's your current reading on the Brits and the Chinese efforts through this telecommunications conglomerate to penetrate them? And
I think that the Brits are, you know, still a large percentage of their conservatives are against getting involved with Huawei. But the business community, the business interests, just like in the United States with our big tech interests, are more than willing to compromise. And so it's going to take leadership from Washington to hold that line. It's really critically important. And I would agree with you that there should be some stipulation in this agreement that if, you know, any one of these nations were to somehow allow Huawei to be, you know, come into their countries and get in you know, injected into their IT backbone that there's no way that this agreement could go forward. We'd have to keep that air gapped and cauterized and separated.
General Mark Milley's conduct. I'm thinking, obviously, most immediately of his willingness to warn the Chinese in the event the United States felt obliged to attack China, which has now, it seems to me, been confirmed as something that he did. Certainly, we know he was communicating with his Chinese counterpart to try to allay concerns about untoward consequences from, you know, relations going south. But Jim, also, just his more general attitude towards China's rise. Give us your thoughts on the man and his fitness to continue to be the top military officer of the United States.
Well, Frank, I have not met him. I haven't worked with him. I just know what he has said publicly. And, you know, we impeached a president for a phone call with a leader of a foreign country. And within, you know, days, weeks, we were provided transcripts that were leaked from that phone call. And then the White House went out and released the entire transcript. And I think if we do that for a president of the United States, then we need to have the transcript of his calls, General Milley's calls with his PRC counterpart. That needs to be released. And we need to then have an investigation into what he did, what he said, and who authorized it. And if it was him acting on his own recognizance, then I believe he should be court-martialed. There's just no room in our system to allow the military to run amok and not be under civilian control. And if that's what happened, we don't know that. But if we find that out, then that cannot be allowed to happen. And what I'm very disappointed in is what I see in the media in the last 24 hours is that it's become a partisan issue, and people are defending the idea that a senior military officer could make his own decision on what he thought was right and how he could take control of nuclear codes and things of this nature, something that we all disapprove of no matter who is in the White House.
And Jim, you have, again, as an intelligence officer, an appreciation of what the implications would be were we to provide forewarning of an attack if one were, you know, directed in our government for whatever reason. How would the Chinese respond?
Well, I think the Chinese probably, if this call in fact did happen and that was those statements were made or implied in such a way, I think that probably their first thought is, what's going on? No one would ever normally do this. So there was probably a bit of shock there. And as the months have gone on, and now as this book excerpt has been released, I'm sure the Chinese now are just combined with what happened in Afghanistan and the other events with the woke education that's going on at the Department of Defense and you know, the exodus of people who don't want to get vaccinated, all these things combined with the crashes of our ships in 2017 and other indicators of unpreparedness and low readiness. I think the Chinese, this just contributes to their calculus, their scientific development of how we decide when to pull the trigger to take Taiwan. And it's not a good sign.
Again, Jim Fennell, from your time in uniform and the work you do these days at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, I know you are as conversant as anybody about what the implications of such a preemptive attack by the Chinese could be. This is treason, it does seem to me, and has to be treated as such. We will be following this closely. Thank you for your time today, sir. Next up, we'll take stock of this and much more with Gordon Chang, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to one of the people that I am most proud is a regular of Secure Freedom Radio. His name is Gordon Chang. He is our duty expert, all things China. He is, I'm happy to say, pretty much regarded that way by just about everybody else, I think, as well. The author of a number of important books, including The Coming Collapse of China. He is essayist of great renown, notably these days at Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute. And you can follow him, as I certainly do, at Gordon G. Chang. It's good to have you back, my friend. Welcome, Gordon.
Thank you so much, Frank.
A lot to talk about. Gordon, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has been much in the news of late for his behavior with respect to the Chinese Communist Party's People's Liberation Army. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about some of the particulars of that. But before we do, one of the things that's just come to light that I'd not been aware of was that back in 2015, he encouraged people to believe that China is not an enemy, and that, in fact, the rise of China is not only underway, but seemingly he thought it was a good thing. This is not unique to him, needless to say. Talk a little bit about this sort of school that China's rise is inevitable, if not actually desirable, something that we better just sort of manage our relationship with, so that our decline, inevitable as well, is not going to be a problem.
General Milley said that China is not an enemy, and it clearly was. But Milley's comments were very much in the mainstream in Washington political thinking, and indeed, not exceptional, at least for that time. I think that that showed the sickness in Washington, the inability to understand who was our friend and who are our enemies, because the Chinese were calling us enemies and were doing things that enemies actually do. So I think this was the obliviousness that is endemic to Washington. And let's remember the consequences of this. We were oblivious to Osama bin Laden, even after the 1996 or so attack on the World Trade Center. So China is much more powerful than Al-Qaeda ever was. So this is important for us to remember that 2001 followed that initial bombing of the World Trade Center. And we Americans have no excuse for not dealing with Osama bin Laden before all of those deaths on 9/11.
And similarly, you don't want to be emboldening an enemy who's vastly more powerful than bin Laden is. Gordon, this brings me to General Milley's conduct with respect to China. There are allegations. I must say I find them increasingly persuasive, as they've not been denied or rebutted, that he actually communicated with his counterpart, General Li, in China about, there would not be any attack coming from the United States, and were there to be one, he would call in advance to warn General Li that it was incoming. How is this likely to be seen by China?
Two things. First of all, I think the Chinese already believed that the U.S. was in disarray and in terminal decline. And General Milley's two calls before and after the November election would reinforce that notion. That meant that it would make the Chinese even more aggressive and belligerent than they already were. And therefore, that did undermine peace and security in the region, as well as the peace and the security of the United States. So that was wrong on that count. Also, there were no indications that China felt that Trump was going to attack. First of all, Trump was not a warlike president by any means. Also, there were no indications of unusual movement of forces in China. There was no civil preparations. There was no change in propaganda. So I don't understand what Milley was talking about. And that would have led General Li to think, why would Milley believe that we think China was going to attack? I mean, what intelligence was there out there? And because there were no objective indications, General Li would have thought that there was a spy within China. So I'm sure that redoubled Beijing's efforts to look for people helping the United States. And that, of course, also would undermine our security. Now, of course, there are constitutional issues, all sorts of ones, but just looking at the Chinese themselves, this really was wrong for Milley to do, because it did undermine our security.
Gordon, let me turn
to no longer be a free person. I think he should be at least court-martialed. Perhaps the Justice Department should consider charges of treason. But clearly, he should no longer have his freedom.
Well, that seems to flow from it. Yes, you're right. Let me ask you about this deal with Australia and the United Kingdom that Joe Biden announced yesterday, involving the transfer of some of our most sensitive nuclear power technologies for submarines to the Aussies. We discussed it a bit with Jim Fennell a moment ago, and I'd be interested in your take on this initiative. Gordon.
Well, first of all, the general partnership, the security pact among Britain, Australia, and the United States is a very important move, and I applaud it. What I found distressing yesterday was when Biden talked about this publicly, he didn't mention China, and comments from administration officials say it's not directed against China. Well, obviously it is. This tars the image of the United States for being plain spoken. We are not worried about an attack from Nauru. And we need to be upfront and clearly say this in public. And one of the reasons why is because the Chinese think that we're still afraid of them, that we're afraid to mention China in public. Well, we need to do that because China is our enemy. Just last month, they came within a millimeter of actually using that term for the United States. And at the same time, they accused us of, quote unquote, barbaric attacks on China. In other words, laying the justification for an attack on the United States. We need to be clear, and this was a fault of the administration. But the general concept of what they did was a very good thing. Now, one can argue about whether what type of submarines the Australians should have. Clearly, they should not have had the French ones. That was a big mistake. They probably should have bought the Japanese Sorus, which are diesel, which are among the quietest submarines in the world. But if they want Virginia-class subs, I think that's a very good thing because it shows that Australia is moving in the direction of projecting power, which means helping us in the South China Sea and East China Sea. I know people are going to say, well, we shouldn't be transferring this technology. But on the other hand, we're at a point where we could lose our country. So we're going to have to take extraordinary measures to defend ourselves. And that means working with one of our closest and most loyal allies.
My principal concern, aside from the possibility of this technology being compromised, Gordon, about this initiative is just that it's going to take so long to bear fruit. 10 years is being bruited at the moment, but I think we'll be lucky if it's that short a time. Are there things that we should be doing with the Australians and the Brits, for that matter, at this time to strengthen deterrence of China, to give the Australians more offensive capability, as you say?
Well, I think one of the important things is something that they were talking about yesterday, and that is basing U.S. attack subs in Australia. This is important for us because it means we can work more closely with Australia, and it puts our submarines at less risk than they would be if they were, for instance, in Japan. So this is important, drawing Australia in. One of the things that, this is a fundamental mistake in the Pentagon right now. The Pentagon is planning for war with China 2030, 2040, whereas they should be planning for war right now. And the reason why this is important is that they want to take down what they call the legacy platforms. In other words, current weapons, in order to fund modernization and research for the weapons of the future. I don't think we're going to be using the weapons of the future. I think we're going to be using the weapons now. And I share your concern that Australia is going on a very long time frame. And indeed, what they should be buying in the interim are Japanese Sorus, which they can buy and have in place right away. Matter of fact, they would be in place right now if they didn't make the wrong decision of going with the French platform.
Very interesting point, and I think very compelling argument, Gordon. Let me turn to one last thing, speaking of submarines. I have to say I was somewhat surprised by the fact that the South Korean government has not only a ballistic missile-capable submarine, but actually test-fired a submarine-launched ballistic missile from it. The other day, in the midst of a number of salvos out of North Korea, by the way. Tell us about what the South Koreans are up to, as you see it, Gordon. And in particular, it's the general perception, I think, that you don't go to the lengths to put submarine-launched ballistic missiles at sea unless you plan to put nuclear warheads aboard. Is that what's going on in South Korea at the moment? What are the implications of that, as you see it?
I think that if you had a candid conversation with a senior South Korean military officer, they would say that they want nukes. And indeed, the U.S. had stopped a South Korean nuclear weapons program. And indeed, after that, they've been caught experimenting with uranium, suggesting that they very much want the world's most destructive weapon. But for South Korea, it makes a lot of sense, even conventional warheads at sea, because what they do is they complicate North Korea's planning immeasurably. And South Korea can do a lot of damage just with conventional warheads. So South Korea has the South Korean military planning is very different, I think, than planning for the United States and others. So I can understand why this makes sense even with conventional warheads. But of course, they'd be more powerful if they had nukes on top of those ballistic missiles.
Well, my guess is that if you build them with the ostensible purpose being conventional payload deliveries, you are building in that option of the nuclear. And as you say, I must confess, I think they'd be foolish not to obtain that deterrent capability in light of not just what the North Koreans are up to, but the Chinese as well. Gordon, speaking of China and South Korea, there are reports that there is growing hostility towards the Chinese among particularly younger South Koreans. I would consider that a welcome development. It's not presumably so welcome in the circles of Moon Jae-in's government, because they have made a point trying to endear themselves to the Chinese, as I understand it. Very quickly, what's going on there? And is this a good thing for the United States if younger South Koreans are warming to the United States again?
Yeah. Among all South Koreans, China is viewed less favorably than even Japan, which is stunning, considering the general trend of the South Korean population. And as you point out, among younger South Koreans, they are more, quote unquote, anti-China than their parents and grandparents. This, to me, is a very welcome development. And it means that we could see maybe a welcome development in next year's presidential election. But in any event, the general trends in South Korean society are in the right direction for the United States, which means the alliance looks like it's in much better shape than it would if you looked at, for instance, the Moon Jae-in administration and what it's been trying to do to undermine us and to break the alliance.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, my friend, I hope that the sentiment of the South Korean people is going to be a break on what appears to be the determination of Moon's team to both normalize relations with North Korea, perhaps unify with it, and certainly become part of the sphere of influence of Communist China, all of which is very worrying indeed. Gordon, we appreciate your insights into all these matters, as well as the close scrutiny that bring to bear on them, and look forward to visiting with you again next week. In fact, we'll look forward to visiting with you Saturday in Dallas, where I am now, and doing a program with you, sponsored by Debbie Georgiadis of America Can We Talk. It's great to have you here, and look forward to seeing you then. Thank you, my friend. Talk to you next week. Next up, we will speak with Dr. Richard Fleming about developments on the COVID front that are shocking.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to a guest we've talked with in the past, but not in some time, and I regret that, and I'm anxious to regroup with him. His name is Dr. Richard Fleming. He has the distinction of being a medical doctor, a juris doctor, an attorney, and a PhD, a man of considerable accomplishment, notably for having developed the theory, of which I believe he now has a patent, that cardiovascular disease was due to inflammation. He has been very vocal, very engaged, very thoughtful, and I think for the layperson like myself, very helpful in his analysis of what is going on with this COVID-19 disease. In fact, he has written a book entitled Is COVID-19 a Bioweapon? A Scientific and Forensic Investigation. He is also involved as an expert witness in perhaps coming proceeding of the International Criminal Court investigating gain-of-function research as bioweapon-related activity and implicating all kinds of people, including Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fleming, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us, sir.
My pleasure to be back. Thank you.
We need to spend a little bit of time, probably level setting, on some of the issues that have prompted you to become so active and concerned about what's going on with COVID-19. Just remind us, if you would, quickly, and again for the lay audience, about why there is reason to believe that what we are confronting is, in fact, a bioweapon, and how it's manifesting itself as such.
Well, there's two decades worth of information that I have in the book, Is COVID-19 a Bioweapon?, where I lay out for people the evidence that shows that the U.S. federal government, including NIAID, Fauci's component of NIH, as well as the NIH and DOD, have provided substantial funding, many tens of millions of dollars, to multiple universities and people like Peter Daszak at Equal Health, who then helped to fund research at the University of North Carolina with Ralph Barrick and Xuzheng Li at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And those two decades worth of grants have been followed with published papers showing these monies were used to change coronaviruses, to make them more infective, to make them more lethal. We've been able to track that. Patents have actually been granted on these procedures, and the federal government, including NIH and NIAID, receive monies from these patents. So there is a very clear, more than two decades worth of data showing that they were actively involved in altering these viruses to make them more infective and more dangerous. The outcome of which is SARS-CoV-2, this coronavirus that we talk about, or COVID-19, which is the disease. There's evidence to show that back in 2002, that SARS-CoV-1 was also developed in the same way, making it a bioweapon, and that MERS, the Mediterranean version from 2007, was also funded by Dr. Fauci's organization and other people in the federal government. There's no benefit to doing this, and the release of these viruses have been obviously problematic for the planet. They've killed people that doctors haven't been allowed to treat as the doctors would want. The vaccines themselves are nothing more than that same genetic sequence that was man-made being put into vaccines. Because of the way these vaccines were designed, they include only a single part, a spike protein of the original virus, the Wuhan HU1 version, which is only one variant of SARS-CoV-2. Like people, these viruses have multiple variants, and if you target just one of them, you'll effectively have an effect on that one, but the others that you haven't targeted will then be allowed to dominate the field. And we've seen this back, the first one was back with the UK last year with the alpha variant. We've seen the beta variant, the gamma variant, the lambda variant, the delta variant, as people have seen, and now the mu variant that's come up from South America. And these vaccines, using this genetic sequence of this bioweapon, so it doesn't matter whether you make it as a virus or you put it in a vaccine and do the same thing, it's still a man-made bioweapon, have done nothing more than pressure selected this virus to continue to demonstrate more infectious viruses. And while President Biden would argue that it is the unvaccinated that are a danger, I would argue that it is the vaccinated that are the danger. But these four people responded, as a lot of people would, to the threats and concerns and the bribery to get these vaccines, being led to believe that somehow this is protecting the people that they love, when in fact all it's done is produce a pressure selection. So we now have a scenario where we are chasing vaccines, or vaccine chasing, as the CEO of Pfizer pointed out just a couple weeks ago, when the variants continue to change sufficiently so that the original designed drug vaccines no longer work within 91 days. And I think that's an impressive number because, you know, they ran this out in 10 months and now they've cut it down to 91 days. They are willing to come up with something new to do more and more chasing and just drive this madness. In medicine, when we do something wrong, we stop or people die. And this is very much the same thing as antibiotic resistant bacteria. When you use an antibiotic over and over and over again, you don't make the person healthier. You increase the risk of developing these resistant bacteria. You stop giving the antibiotic. The intelligent scientific medical thing to do at this point in time is stop this massive vaccination program. On the website FlemingMethod.com, you can go to the first tab and drop down to the second, I forget what it's, the heading is to it, but it will walk you through vaccine chasing. And you can see in 33 countries, as the vaccines have been used, how the number of cases of infections have gone up and the variants have been pushed over to the Delta and now mu variant. So the data is very clear on what's going on. It's not confusing at all. The science is very clear. It's the people talking about the science that are unclear in many instances.
But I guess the larger question I wanted to just explore with you, Doctor, is given what you've said, and again, our guest is Dr. Richard Fleming, is there any basis for compelling people to get vaccinated with the existing vaccines, whether it's the Pfizer one or Moderna or Johnson & Johnson, should we be terminating that program rather than making it obligatory and creating through vaccine passport initiatives means of essentially punishing people if they don't get vaccinated?
Right. Well, the intelligent thing to do right now, scientifically, medically, and I think legally, is to put a halt on this program and require an investigation of exactly what has happened up until this point in time. These folks have run amok with a development of a virus, with the development of drug vaccine biologics, as I call them, because they have a biological effect upon people. And they've not been held to accountability. There is very good data that's already been published that shows that these vaccines in and of themselves suppress the very part of our immune system that needs to be activated. The initial T helper cells from the innate system needs to be activated for us to make the type of antibodies that are needed. And that data shows that those T helper 2 cells are suppressed. There is data now that shows that once these vaccines are used and then they test people for influenza, that the expected response to influenza, the protection for influenza, no longer happens. So these vaccines are actually reprogramming our innate immune system. And everybody wants to talk about antibodies, but you can't make antibodies effectively without this innate immune system. It's the foundation of our immune system. And none of that has been talked about by Dr. Fauci or anybody in the federal government. I don't expect President Biden to talk about it. President Biden is not a scientist. He's not a physician. His wife has a PhD in something. I think it's education. But again, I think when people use the term doctor, there is the presumption by way too many people that this is perhaps an MD who knows what they're talking about. There are an awful lot of people that have PhDs and other things that are talking about science and medicine that just simply aren't qualified to do it. And so I understand completely how the general public is confused.
And what is also at work, which I gather is confusing many besides myself, is the degree to which we're seeing people who are in the healthcare profession, some including at NIH itself, the National Institute of Health, but in frontline, healthcare facilities around the country and so on, who are declining to be vaccinated. And in some cases, at least, they're being forced off the job, which will result in the closure of those medical facilities. I mean, this seems on the face of it to be highly counterproductive, to say the least. Dr. Fleming, we are going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about, but I did want to just ask you, when you are approaching this from a public policy point of view, what are we to make of the fact that in these vaccine mandates, and presumably the vaccine passports in some way, shape, or form will have to reflect this as well, there are large numbers of people, White House personnel, congressional members and personnel, staff, and Postal Service personnel among them, who are being exempted from these mandates. It seems as though this is fundamentally about politics, really, maybe control at that, rather than about science and medicine and public health. Am I missing something here, sir?
No, I think it's hypocritical to call for people to be mass vaccinated when the evidence shows that the vaccines do not, in the emergency use authorization documents, do not reduce COVID cases or death cases, and yet have all these associated side effects. And when the federal government will allow some of its people to avoid being vaccinated while at the same time mandating other people and calling unvaccinated individuals criminals or terrorists.
Or murderers.
Or murderers runs amok. I mean, this is Joseph Mengele is rolling over in his grave right now thinking, my goodness, had I just been alive in 2021, I could have done anything to humans that I wanted to under the guise of being part of the federal government. Anybody who's talking about the best outcomes for Americans or anybody in the world would recognize that this system has run amok and there are people to be held accountable that should be held accountable. Do you have proof that you may move around? Well, last time I checked, the U.S. Constitution doesn't give the federal government that type of power over the people.
And worse yet, Doctor, if I could just say in closing that the passport's propensity to translate those papers about your health status into essentially the equivalent of the Chinese social credit system, which puts all of your data into places where it can be both monitored and, you know, used to reward or punish your behavior. It is a very mortal threat to not just, I think, probably public health, but also to the freedoms that we revere and cherish in this country. Dr. Richard Fleming, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but we're going to return to this topic with you soon, and I appreciate so much your time and the chance to reconnect with you. It's been too long, and your insights and your service are really appreciated, as is your new book, Is COVID-19 a Bioweapon? I encourage everybody to get their hands on. We'll talk with you again soon, sir. Thank you so much for joining us. Come back to us in the near future. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman, get his take on China and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Evidently, the nation's top military officer has indeed betrayed our country. Through a spokesman yesterday, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley confirmed that he had conversations last October and in January with his Chinese counterpart aimed at, quote, avoiding unintended consequences or conflict, unquote. That characterization appears to be an effort to spin Milley's reported promise to warn the People's Liberation Army if we were going to attack China. Evidently, the general has also extracted from his senior subordinates what he saw as an oath to him that could conflict with their oaths to support and defend the Constitution. Such outrages demand the JCS chairman's resignation and/or his court-martialing. Unfortunately, President Biden declared yesterday that he had, quote, great confidence in General Milley, quote, we can have none in either man or other U.S. officials like them who favor China's rise. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're joined by Kevin Freeman, one of our more or less regulars. We've gotten a little out of sync with Kevin, but we're hoping to get back in the groove with him because he contributes mightily, both to this program and through his own television program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. You can follow that at economicwarroom.com. You can also check out Kevin's writings and musings at globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is our duty expert at the Center for Security Policy, for which he is a senior fellow, and here at Secure Freedom Radio, and all things economic warfare, and it's always a delight to have him with us. Kevin is also the author of Secret Weapon and Game Plan, two terrific books on very compelling subjects, which all of us need to be following closely. Kevin, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It is so good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be back.
Let me start by asking you about a development that we discuss in a new paper of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, of which we're very happy to say you are an important member, about China biting the hand that feeds it, or that has to date, at least, namely our capital markets. Specifically, it draws on some very important warnings by an unlikely source, George Soros, about the inadvisability of Americans investing in communist China. Talk a little bit about this remarkable development, and is it just a case, do you think, of the broken clock being right twice a day? or does this signal a change in the environment that even George Soros now feels he must join in mourning about?
Well, I think it's an extraordinary shocker for all of us. George Soros, on the side of democratic systems and freedom and liberty versus the repression of China. It's unbelievable. Here's what's happened. Over the past 20 years, China has sold us that they're a great global partner and they're heading towards the global utopia that George Soros has been pushing for, which is remade under his image. Xi Jinping has decided, no, that China is the master of the universe, that they're the middle kingdom and they deserve to be in charge of everything. And so they've come in conflict. Wall Street has been funding China, all of this, which Soros has noted. And unfortunately, I think this is a terribly bad signal. If Xi Jinping no longer cares what Soros and others think, that means that they're preparing for a very serious conflict.
That is the leitmotif here, it seems to me, is most of the things China is doing at the moment, whether it is crushing U.S. investors in their capital markets, or whether it is more broadly, it seems, shutting down supply chains, or whether it is, you know, pulling out of Hollywood as a kind of precursor to a conflict with the United States and presumably others as well. And this is going on against the backdrop of the drama that's playing out, of course, with General Mark Milley. And it does seem as though when people like him profess that China is not our enemy, it is further indication of just how ill-suited for the very important position he currently holds as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley is. But let me just ask you, as you look at Soros's warnings, what he is particularly focused on, you and I have talked about it often over the years, Kevin, is the role being played by Larry Fink and his company, BlackRock, in promoting Chinese interests at the expense of American investors, including, among others, of course, BlackRock's own clients. What's up with that?
Well, Larry Fink, who is the biggest advocate of socially responsible investing, then takes client dollars and pushes them into the least socially responsible market in the world, which is China, where they interfere at will, where they don't care about human rights. They do human organ harvesting, where they have the social credit system. All of these things are anti what is being sold, which is a bait and switch, and which is exactly what Soros calls out. But just going back to the previous point, China is either preparing and getting on a war footing for a major conflict, or the other alternative, some believe that China is imploding internally financially. Either one of them is bad, because if they implode completely internally under Xi Jinping, they will move to a war footing. And the idea that we would support that financially is outrageous. And if even George Soros sees it, something needs to be done. The SEC needs to step up and immediately start looking at all these Chinese companies. For 20 years, we've told investors, invest in Chinese companies and you'll get rich as China grows and succeed. That's no longer the outlook. That's not what any rational person could see at this point. And the fact that Larry Fink and others are pushing American investors that direction, that's frightening.
Speaking of which, in your economic war room programming, you recently did a segment on privatized communism by woke corporations. I would assume that BlackRock under its CEO Larry Fink would be one of the preeminent examples of this phenomenon. Is it, Kevin? And what's the most important takeaway from that program, as you see?
Well, here's the reality, is that there are two ways you can do things. You can do things the old-fashioned way, which is you communists take over and you kill a bunch of people. The other way you can do it is you can leave the appearance of ownership in a system to where the companies work for the state. And so we talked about ESG and how they're implementing a lot of political objectives via corporations. And here's another one. You want to have everybody get the shot, and therefore you'll use OSHA to require the companies to require their employees to do it. It's not a direct government mandate, but and Larry Fink and ESG, they're doing the very same things, mandating that corporations toe the line, which is really implementing progressive leftist policies.
It certainly is. And progressive, I think, is one of those euphemisms that disguises what really is afoot. And I was pleased to see you put a fine point on it in your programming. It's communism. It's Marxism that these guys are championing. And to the extent that the capitalists have thrown in with them, it certainly bespeaks, I think, Kevin, a mutation of capitalism, the so-called stakeholder capitalism, that is wholly at odds, really, with the underpinning of a free market system and portends its doom, does it not?
Stakeholder capitalism is communism. It's where, you know, from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs, we take care of all the stakeholders. It goes against Milton Friedman. It goes against the free market system. It goes against shareholder ownership. You know, and we've covered that. We've done multiple shows on what's wrong with stakeholder capitalism. It sounds great. It really is backdoor communism.
Right. And a way of insinuating it into our government, our country, our economic system, for sure. Which brings me to another way. And Kevin, you've been at the forefront, I think, of warning about this. Talk about programmable money and how it could fit in with a sort of social credit system like China's to advantage certain favored people and to punish others and otherwise exercise a measure of control that is totally antithetical to, you know, our constitutional system and freedoms, but may well be in distinct prospect now, especially if these vaccine passports conduce to it.
Well, our government is desperate to have the authority and the power that the Chinese government has to monitor, control, and the people of the country. And they're doing it through whatever means possible, whether it's NSA listening in on phone calls or whatever. And there are laws that protect you on that. But programmable money is one where we will sign up for it and willingly give all our information, where that money is only good if the government says it's good. For example, if you're given digital currency, digital dollars, which is they're working on it now, you can only spend them in a certain zip code if the government wants to limit you to and your travel. You can only spend them for a certain time period if the government wants to increase your spending or decrease your spending. They're not good for a certain period of time. If you're overweight, they're not good at McDonald's and certain places where they think it's bad for your health. And now there's a new one that just came out, a MasterCard that's a carbon tracking credit card. It analyzes your purchases to determine how much carbon emissions you've created so that they can help you. And people are running to it because it'll make me a better citizen. I'll bet. No, you're handing the government control over every aspect of your lives. And if they can control the money, it's the mark of the beast type stuff from the Bible, where you're not allowed to buy or sell unless the government approves it.
Kevin Friedman, this is such an important topic to which I hope we can return with you soon. It is really vital, and it's exemplary of the kind of clarity that you bring to so many of these issues and the early warning system that your terrific program, Economic War Room, provides all of us. Keep it up, my friend, and come back to us again very soon, if you would. Hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.